On WFAN, it's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with you for the next 30 minutes of frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction. And happy to have Jim with us this morning, a fellow gambler in recovery. Jim, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, and good morning. It's great to be here.
Yeah, appreciate you coming on. We started this show for 5 years now the same way every single week, and that's with me asking the question, what was the date of your last wager?
April 23rd, 2003.
Wow, so 22 years in recovery. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
All right, let's go by fast. Yeah, right? In the moment, it never does. When you look back on it, it's like, wow, that's a lot of time. Between my last wager. Let's tell your story here a bit. How old were you when you first were exposed to gambling before it became a problem?
Probably a kid playing, pitching for pennies, which a lot of young people probably don't even know what that is. Playing for marbles, starting to play poker with my friends, that kind of stuff, getting scratch offs for Christmas. So it was always around, but it wasn't really an issue early on.
Do you remember when you look back on your youth as with clarity now that it made you feel a certain way, or was there a long period of time, at least as a kid, when it was as normal as it was for everybody else?
No, I think that I really loved it. I always wanted to do it, but I couldn't find other people to sort of engage with me because they weren't that excited about, doing these kinds of activities.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. That's a unique take. We haven't heard a lot of that, but you have a zen for it. You like it. It makes you feel a certain way. But, you're kind of alone in the wilderness, and it's hard to say to somebody, hey, let's play more, because it's not their thing.
Exactly.
And then how old were you when you started gambling more than, let's say, the average kid your age would gamble?
Probably in college, because then there were more players readily available, and that was poker.
Okay.
And in my senior year, it was way out of control. My roommate also gambled excessively. We actually created games, card games, where we would play for the other person while the other one was in class. And I'd come back and be down X amount of dollars, and then we're up X amount of dollars. So I'm like, oh, okay, so that's fine. So I could say
let me stop you there, though. Whoever that friend was, that is the most loyal, honest friend you could ever possibly have.
I know, right? So it was probably out of control at that point.
Yeah. And where did you go to college, if you don't mind me asking?
Northern Illinois.
Gotcha. Was that far away from home or was that close?
Far away. I grew up overseas. All my family was overseas, so this was quite a ways from home.
Got it. When you think about gambling as a younger man, as a college senior, and obviously you had what seems like a special bond with a roommate or a buddy that you were kind of in cahoots with from a gambling standpoint, do you remember processing gambling as a way to maybe, I don't know, escape, homesickness or loneliness or being so far away? Or was it just something you truly just enjoyed and that's all it was, enjoyment?
No, looking back at it, it was probably, there's some escape components to it. There's probably some of the action as well as also some narcissistic behavior traits that I had that I wanted to see if I could control things that were out of my control.
Right.
So, so a little bit of everything, really.
And was poker the main culprit from a gambling standpoint, or did you get to a place where it was any kind of gambling?
Oh, it was any kind of gambling after a while. You know, when they opened up casinos, riverboats in the Chicago area, I was aware enough that I knew that if I started going, it would probably develop into a serious problem. So I waited probably about 18 months after they opened before I went for the first time.
That's interesting to me. So you were cognitively aware that you liked it maybe too much, but made a conscious decision as a young man, a relatively immature man at 21, 22 years old, that you knew that if you went to the casino, it was going to be a problem. That's interesting to me.
Yeah. But I was aware, but eventually that urge or that thought of going to see what it was like, I gave into that and escalated from, playing just small wagers on the blackjack table primarily into, at the end, it was roulette because nothing else was fast enough for me.
Yeah, that's why I asked you about poker, because I'm always interested in guys that are addicted to quote-unquote slower games. You know, because my addiction was blackjack, specifically because of what you just talked about with roulette, and that is the speed. You know, especially playing alone, I could control the speed, and I played as fast as a human could possibly play. Like, I've told this story many times. I was so eager to play as many hands as I could in an hour that I would make a phone call from a helicopter, a plane, a car, that I was on my way in, shuffle the decks now so they're ready to go when I get there, just so that I could maximize how much I could play.
I can fully understand that concept. So, it was all about the speed of it. And playing poker, there was just not enough action.
Yeah, that's why people, like, it's funny. People ask me all the time about, you know, when Texas Hold'em became such a big deal in this country after the Chris Moneymaker win at the World Series of Poker, then every guy that had a Friday night game suddenly thought they were going to be the next, you know, great poker player in the country. And I was a good poker player. I could hold my own against just about anybody, but I hated it.
So can I.
I hated it because, you know, there was no action. And if you're really good at Texas Hold'em, maybe you play 10% of your hands maximum, you know, and I couldn't stand for that.
Yeah, I couldn't either. Just not enough. I needed the constant turnover.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, I had a deal with Hard Rock down in Hollywood. And I convinced them once that we should do a satellite tournament prior to, you know, the World Series. And we had this great deal where I went down to Hollywood, Florida, and I hosted the satellite tournament. And the winner of the tournament got the $10,000 entry fee into the World Series. So it was a pretty big deal. So several hundred people came to play. And part of my deal was that I had to also play. They were paying me a good amount of money to fly down there, you know, to host it. So I had to play. So I sit down at the table with the guys and I looked everyone in the eye and I said, look, I want to be very straight with you and I want to apologize in advance. I'm not trying to win this thing, right? I have to play. It's a contractual obligation to play. I said, I'm going to go all in on every single hand. And I know that sucks. And I know one of you is going to double up and it's not fair to the rest of you. But I have no interest in playing for the next 3 days because that's what it would have been had you advanced each round, right? And I'll never forget, in the first hour, I didn't lose a hand. So now I'm sitting there. It's only an hour into a three-day tournament. And, you know, I got the best chip count in the room.
Wow.
And obviously, eventually, I crapped out on purpose.
Sure.
But I couldn't stand not playing. So for you, so when you're at college and now you're walking into the casino and you've expanded the gambling beyond just poker, give us an idea of how quickly it escalated into being a problem.
Probably immediately. It was, you know, blowing off work, making lies about where money was. Probably within 3-4 years, I was borrowing money from friends. You know, it became sort of everything in my life revolved around the gambling. So, you know, when I went to sleep at night, it's like, okay, how do I get money to play tomorrow and cover my losses from today? It was a preoccupation around everything.
Yeah, it's all encompassing. I always say one of the craziest things for me in recovery was, what do I do with all the brain space I now have when I'm not worried about money, worried about gambling, thinking about where I'm going to gamble, the lies I'm going to tell so I can go gamble. And you don't realize it when you're in it, but it's 24/7, 365. You talked about borrowing money from friends. You know, obviously any compulsive gambler has experienced, you know, some tremendous losses. You know, there's some wins that certainly come along with that as well from time to time for a lot of people. Did you ever get yourself in a bad spot financially where you couldn't pay people back, or you borrowed from the wrong people, or you were in really financial problems?
Yeah, in March of 2003, I walked into an FBI office and told them I stole a bunch of money from my clients. I used to work as a financial advisor.
Wow.
So ended up with a 33-month sentence.
All right, so that counts
as trouble.
Yeah, well, that's trouble. Like, you know, I as you know, I went away as well. Walk us through, I don't want to sugarcoat that. Walk us through kind of what was happening that led you to steal money from clients and then ultimately turn yourself in.
Well, it started off with, you know, I basically exhausted all the money that my partner and I had, and she had caught me gambling. You know, I'd lost the down payment for our first house, which, you know, doesn't make you the girlfriend happy at the time. So all these things. So eventually she was sort of closing the doors of access to funds. And I was self-employed, so I had a lot of income. And eventually I couldn't, you know, she found out more and more and closed more doors. And eventually I said, okay, well, I have client money accessible, technically, not really, but, you know, in my mind, I'm like, I'm just going to give myself a loan and then I'm going to pay it back when I have more money coming in next week. And the first time I did that, that's exactly what I did. I took money, I paid it back. And I did that probably 3-4 times over a few months. And then eventually I didn't pay it back. And then I was chasing to cover everything, and it just escalated to where it was, I took over $500,000.
I'm going to stop you right there. We'll take a very quick break. We'll hear more of this story right after this on Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Fascinating story of a fellow gambler in recovery right now. So when we went to the break, you told us that you had borrowed money that wasn't yours with the idea, and we all the same idea. You know, I'm not stealing it. I'm going to pay it back as soon as I win. And you got away with it the first couple times. And then you got yourself in a spot where you borrowed, didn't pay it back, and I assume kept borrowing, thinking tonight will be the night I have the big win. I'll pay it all back. Is that kind of the thought process?
Yep, that's it. It's exactly the standard right. Distorted thinking. It's what we all think, right? And that's what I did too.
And then you wind up $500,000 in the hole, and obviously you don't have the means to pay that back.
No, exactly.
Now, did your clients find out at that moment that their money was missing, or did they not, you know, hip to it yet?
No, they found out too. So, and my ex said, I can't have the police show up here. I want you to, you know, you need to take care of this, which is what sort of led me to go to the FBI, because I did care enough to say I don't want her to have that experience. Wow. The feds would show up. So I went to the FBI in Chicago.
So that's got to be, of all the things you did back then, the most selfless thing you ever did.
Probably.
Right, like, because
I'm selfish.
Right, yeah, but I say that because I'm speaking for myself. I don't want to speak for you on this, but there's a lot of commonality in the addiction. And one of the things a lot of us have in common is an out-of-control ego, you know, the narcissism you talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you hadn't, you know, gotten into recovery yet, but you obviously thought enough of your partner and her family, even though you did gamble a couple times after the intervention, that you didn't want her or them to have to live through the FBI coming to you, yeah?
Yeah, yes, that is correct.
Wow, it actually says a lot about you and who you really are, as opposed to who you were when you were gambling. At least I'm not a therapist, but yeah, that's what I take out of it. So walk us through the morning you wake up when you decide, you know, you're essentially going to turn yourself in. The FBI, maybe you're not even on their radar yet, but you're now going to do the right thing. Walk us through that day.
So I took a train downtown Chicago. I walked into the FBI office and I said, I would like to speak to somebody. I've taken some money from my clients and I need to talk to them. And they told me to leave. They basically said, we'll catch up with you. And then I said, no, I really want to talk to somebody. And they asked, are you high? Are you on drugs? Are you drunk? What's going on? And they're like, go sit down there, think about this for a few minutes. And then I said, no, I really want to do this. And, you know, I still had suicidal ideation going on in my head. And so they called finally, like 2 hours later, an agent showed up. I told them everything that was going on. And they said, okay. We'll catch up. If you leave a phone number, we'll call you. And I walked out.
I assume you walked out dissatisfied, yeah?
Yeah, I was like, look, this was strange. I thought I was going to be handcuffed, fingerprinted, all that stuff. None of that happened.
And then how long after that walk-in did they come knocking?
They called me and said, can I come down? And when I came down, there were a lot more people in the room, the NASD, the SEC, the posts. Postal inspector, the FBI, there was like eight different agencies across from me.
So it's interesting. So you went in, told them a story they probably had no interest in hearing. Then they took some time to investigate it, realized that you weren't BSing them and this was happening in real. And then they got their ducks in order and then they called you back in.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. And was there a thinking when you started that process that you did you at any point did you regret doing it?
No, it was relief because, you know, for a long time, I talked about the suicidal ideation. I think for a long time, I prayed for near-death experience because I wanted to wake up from this not participating in life because of gambling. It was like life was passing me by and all the only thing that was taking place in my life was gambling. And I had always prayed for a near-death experience to sort of get me out of that cycle.
Okay.
And I started viewing that this was that answer to the prayer, not in the way that I wanted it to. It was going to be a lot more long-term, but in hindsight, it was the best thing that happened to me, really saved my life.
Sure. And I assume no trial, you just pled guilty and worked out a deal with the Fed, something like that?
I did. I pled guilty and worked out a deal, and it was, you know, they were contesting the fact that it was my crime was gambling motivated and wanted to add charges for obstruction if I wanted to go down that path. Because they, at that time, federal law did not acknowledge gambling as a contributing factor.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So even though you come clean, you're trying to do the right thing, you own up to every dollar you stole, they still mm-hmm. busted your balls and made it hard for you to do the right thing. That's fascinating to
yeah.
me.
Well, so I can tell you that, so the judge, I'd already surrendered because I couldn't get work and anything else. So I was in the Metropolitan Correctional Center for a while I was waiting to get sentenced. And as I was getting sentenced, there were two other gentlemen in front of me to get sentenced. One was busted with 400 kilos of cocaine, and the other one had hundreds of assault rifles and other weapons.
Right.
And when it was my turn, the judge said, "You are a menace to society." And I'm in shock. I'm like, "You didn't say that to these two other guys ahead of me." And I'm like, "What the heck is this?" And my jaw literally hit the floor. And I'm like, yeah. this can't be real. But he explained. He said, "The reality is," and I had obviously brought in a specialist to show that I was, you know, I scored a 9 out of 9 or on the diagnostic for gambling
right.
and all that stuff. And he said, "It is very likely you're going to go back to gambling. And if you do, I'm pretty certain that you're going to commit more crime and we may not catch you." Hmm. And that's why you're a menace to society.
And he gave you a 33-month sentence on that?
Yeah. Yes.
And how much time did you actually do?
28 months.
28 months. Was it a federal prison camp or a low? Where were you at?
I was started in Metropolitan Correctional Center in Chicago, which is medium. Then I was in transit for a month, and then I ended up at a low facility in Morgantown, West Virginia at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that is crazy. And how long did it take you to really get into GA and recovery and commit yourself to a life without gambling? Was it that moment?
No. So after I went to the feds, it still took 11 months for them to process and investigate my case because they thought that I was lying about the gambling, and that since I had overseas connections, that I was hiding money overseas. So it took them 11 months from the time I told them everything till they found out that I was telling the truth. So I went to GA starting at that. And my last day of freedom was actually a GA conference in Chicago that was Saturday and Sunday. And I went to jail on Monday morning.
Wow. What a crazy story. And when you and obviously it's been 20 plus years now, so yeah. Life, I'm sure, is great. I assume you're not with the same woman you were with back then?
No, but I've been in a stable relationship for the past 18 years.
Great. Do you miss gambling at all?
No. You know, I always the way I look at it is it's always there. I don't have overwhelming urges or anything. I look
right.
at it this way. If I have a list of things I can do, I'm a big list guy. I love lists. So I make lists of everything I need to do in a day.
Sure.
There might be 300 things on that list that I could do today. Gambling may be number 272, and I rarely get past 32.
Got it. That's well. Listen, if that's how you compartmentalize getting through the day, you know, more power to you. That's what works for you. That's great.
Yeah.
When you tell your story, and I think it's great. I could spend 3 hours talking to you because we're obviously glossing over a lot of the nitty gritty and specifics.
Sure.
And we could certainly get into that another day and let you share some of the stories, the highs and lows of being a compulsive gambler at the level you were. But when you do share your story, it's very powerful, and it obviously helps other people, which is why I'm so glad to be able to talk to you. But when you meet someone or, you know, talk to someone, and I know you obviously, you know, we share Dan as a friend in common. When you see someone who's, kind of at step one of all this, and I talk about this all the time, you know, the walls are caving in. You don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. You can't imagine what your life would be like, you know, a year from now without gambling. What's the kind of overall messaging you try to give someone who's literally at day one of this thing?
I tell them if I could share a little bit of what I have inside and put it in their soul, that they would understand that there's hope, that there's always a path forward, and that life, there's a life after gambling, and it's a good life. And my life is good right now. And
is,
that's
right?
Probably what I tell them. Yeah, it is. And I think that's what I tell them. And the other thing I also share with them, that nobody wakes up in one day and say, you know, today's a great day to become a compulsive gambler. Nobody's ever done that. And yet it happens.
That's very true.
Right?
But yeah. And by the way, none of us go into it thinking we're going to be the compulsive gambler. It always starts innocently, recreationally, responsibly, fun with friends. And then the whatever the reason is, the way we're wired, whatever it might be, you know, outside influences, you know, trauma, whatever it might be, you know, nobody sets off, much like I'm sure an alcoholic doesn't start off thinking they're going to become an alcoholic, but the way, you know, their body processes booze is similar to how our minds process, you know, the gambling. And it comes to a point, it's hard for people who have no connection to it to understand when I say to them, it's not about the money. Even though we glorify the amounts of money we win and we lose, and we're willing to put at risk, when you become a compulsive gambler, the amounts are irrelevant. It's the need to play.
Yeah. What I tell people is what makes me a compulsive gambler is that my true wager is my hopes and dreams, and the hopes and dreams of the people around me.
That's well said. Just out of morbid curiosity, did you ever reconcile with your girlfriend back then?
No. I wrote her a letter, and then at some point I said, you know, I don't have the right to interfere with her life anymore.
Right.
You know, it took a long time to get over that and really process that. But I understand that it's not all about me. And she had suffered enough from it. You know, her last words to me were, we could have been great together, but I can't keep my self-respect and stay with you.
And I respect that. I'm sure you do, too. I get it.
Yeah,
completely.
You get it.
Well, listen, Jim, it's a pleasure talking to you. I'd love to have you on again in the future and tell more of the story, because obviously 30 minutes isn't enough to cut it. And I don't know if you hear this anymore, but I'm proud of you. This amount of time in recovery is what, you know, I'm gunning for, you know, and I can't get there until the calendar passes 12 more years. But I feel comfortable. I will get there. And I look at people like you as an inspiration. And I can't thank you enough for spending the time with us today and sharing your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, what a great story. And I'm so privileged that people like Jim are willing to spend 30 minutes of their day talking to me and to Dan when he joins us on the show about, you know, moments in their life that are, frankly, the single most depressing, worst moments they've ever experienced. And I think we need to share our stories more and more, because there are the growing number of addicts out there and compulsive gamblers is not going to stop. You may have seen Missouri just approved legalized gambling. So that's, I think, the 39th state now that has it. And more people are going to present with the same problems that I had and that Jim had. And we will continue to do the show for as long as WFN will allow us. And I think it's really important work and really important that we do it. And I can't thank you guys enough for letting us into your cars and homes and ears. And we'll do it again next week. Thank you so much for listening to Hello, My Name is Craig.